scan. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay. But all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s. In an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump, and if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that, today we're taking a look to see what those effects are. We're looking at the fish. We're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and understanding what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer, an explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedour Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Bedour Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the international platform for munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bedour Lakes. Terry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had. Because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6, 7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bedore Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bedore Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. Tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons, and many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act, because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
A United Nations body wrote to the British government to express very extreme concern about its failure to address structural, institutional, and systematic racism against people of African descent in Britain. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to figures that have led to warnings that racism, poverty and pressure on Britain's National Health Service must be tackled to prevent future fatalities, black babies in England are almost three times more likely to die than white babies after death rates surged in the last year. According to figures from the National Child Mortality Database, which gathers standardized data on the circumstances of children's deaths, the death rate for white infants has stayed steady at about 3 per 1,000 live births since 2020. But for black infants and black British babies, it has risen from just under 6 to almost 9 per 1,000. Infant death rates in the poorest neighborhoods rose to double those in the richest areas, where death rates actually fell. The mortality for Asian and Asian British babies also rose by 17%. The annual data shows overall child mortality increased again between 2022 and 2023, with widening inequalities between rich and poor areas and white and black communities. Most deaths of infants under the age of one were due to premature births. Karen Lloyd, the programme lead for the database and a professor of neonatal medicine at Bristol University, said many black and minority ethnic women were not registering their pregnancies early enough and the system needs to reach them in a better way. Karen Lloyd added, "There's an element of racism and there's a language barrier. Minority women often do not feel welcome. There's cultural incompetence, and our clinical teams do not have the skills to understand different cultures. The figures showed that 50 more black babies died in the year to April 2023 than in the previous year. The UK's Labour Party noted that stark racial disparities in the changing mortality rates were scandalous. Annalise Dawes, the Shadow Women and Equalities Secretary, said Labour will work to close this shocking gap and to close racial disparities across our health service with a new Race Equality Act. The Race Equality Foundation described the figures as shocking but devastatingly not surprising. A spokesperson added, "We have known for some time that maternity care and mortality rates for black, Asian and minority ethnic women and children are far higher than for the rest of the population." The spokesperson added, "Without leadership in health institutions and a real desire for change, more infants will die." Website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Overall, the rate of deaths of Britain's black children aged from birth to 17 years old is now at its highest level since the database launched in April of 2019. The highest death rate for those over a year old continued to be for children aged between 15 and 17. There was also a second consecutive increase in death rates among babies under the age of one. Karen Lloyd, a professor of neonatal medicine at Bristol University, said, "If child mortality is going up, it means the health of our children is deteriorating." She added, "This is just the tip of the iceberg." In more than a quarter of the deaths reviewed in last year, expert panels identified achievable interventions that could reduce the risk of future child deaths. The proportion of deaths that could be avoided in future by doing things differently has increased. In 29% of all deaths reviewed, the children were or had been known to social care services, up from 24% in 2020. Karen Lloyd said, "There is evidence here that we can change this. We know that interventions can reduce child mortality and now need to implement things that we know work." She stated, "That was not happening currently because our health system are under extreme duress after the pandemic. A third of children are living in poverty and families are fighting to survive." A Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, "Maternity care must be the same high standard for everyone." The spokesperson added, "In March, National Health Service England publishes its 3-year plan for maternity and neonatal services, which sets out how it will make maternity and neonatal care safer, more personalised and more equitable for women, for babies and for families." The spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care added, "NHS England has also published guidance for local maternity systems, supported by £6.8 million, focusing on actions to reduce disparities for women and babies from ethnic minorities and those living in the most deprived areas." The spokesperson added, "Alongside this, we have set up the Maternity Disparities Task Force, which brings together experts from across the health system, government departments and the voluntary sector to explore and consider evidence-based interventions to tackle maternal disparities." Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A United Nations body wrote to the British government to express very extreme concern about its failure to address structural, institutional and systematic racism against people of African descent in Britain. The United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent calls for an immediate and unconditional moratorium on the use of joint enterprise warning it was leading to the disproportionate imprisonment of black adolescents. The working group said in a statement, "We have serious concerns about impunity and the failure to address racial disparities in the criminal justice system, deaths in police custody, joint enterprise convictions, and the dehumanizing nature of the stop-and-strip search." The United Nations added that Britain's austerity measures has exacerbated racism and racial discrimination for people of African descent, which had an adverse impact on their fundamental rights. Speaking at a press conference in London, Dominique Day, one of the five members of the United Nations Working Group, said, "I've never visited a country before where there is a culture of fear pervading in black communities, relating to a range of asylum, residency, and policing issues. An entire community experiences constant and ongoing human rights violations as a routine and normalized part of their daily life." Officials said they had had a robust discussion about their preliminary research with the UK Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch. A 19-page summary of recommendations was sent to the British government on Friday. The working group noted the continuing fallout from the Windrush scandal. The Windrush scandal was a British political scandal that began in 2018 concerning people who were wrongly detained, denied legal rights, threatened with deportation, and in at least 83 cases wrongly deported from Britain by the Home Office.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
An Israeli minister has claimed that dropping a nuclear bomb on the blockaded Gaza Strip is an option. The Israeli Heritage Minister Eliyahu made the remarks in an interview with Radio Kol Barama. Eliyahu also insisted that allowing any humanitarian aid into Gaza was wrong, claiming there is no such thing as uninvolved civilians in Gaza, calling the innocent civilian population in Gaza Nazis. Following the remarks, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspended the minister from cabinet meetings. Hamas resistance movement, however, pointed out that Eliyahu's remarks were reflective of the Netanyahu regime's genocidal mindset.
The statement by what is called the Israeli Heritage Minister in the Zionist cabinet that throwing a nuclear weapon on the Gaza Strip is one of the solutions didn't come out of nowhere, but it is an expression on the level of decadence, Nazism and sadism that takes place in the minds of the cabinet of the occupying entity that is based on murder and genocide.
The remarks also drew condemnation from around the Arab world, and Iran called for a swift international response. The United Nations Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency must take immediate and uninterrupted action to disarm this barbaric and apartheid regime. Russia has joined a chorus of condemnation that was sparked over controversial remarks made by an Israeli minister about the regime's openness to a nuclear strike in the Gaza Strip. Maria Zakharova, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, said that the main issue was that Israel appeared to have admitted that it had nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other Arab states have all denounced the comments. Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Aboulteit has said the remarks revealed that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, which is an open secret. He also added that the comments also confirm the truth of the racist view Israelis hold against Palestinians. Since Israel's war began on Gaza on October the 7th, the Israeli military has dropped more than 25,000 tons of explosives on Gaza, equivalent in power to two of the nuclear bombs used on Hiroshima. Euromed Human Rights Monitor has said Israel has admitted to bombing over 12,000 targets in the Gaza Strip, with a record tally of bombs exceeding 10 kilograms of explosives per individual. Israel's use of internationally banned weapons in its attacks on the Gaza Strip has also been documented, especially the use of cluster and phosphorus bombs. The Israeli regime is estimated to possess 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the sole possessor of non-conventional arms in the Middle East and the wider West Asia region. Tel Aviv, however, neither admits nor denies owning the weapons under a policy of deliberate nuclear ambiguity. It has also defied international calls for it to sign the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT, something that further corroborates its running of an offensive nuclear weapons program. The United Nations General Assembly has already backed a resolution urging the regime to give up its nuclear weapons and join the NPT.
Gaza Strip skyline. Israel's bombing campaign continues. An apocalyptic scene. It appears Israel is using the banned white phosphorus bombs again. Bombs which burns the skin down to the bone. The death toll continues to mount, like at the Al-Maghazi camp. 51 Palestinians murdered. Another massacre on top of the others. Genocide on speed. The cries over the loss of a beloved one, which is why people are angry worldwide. But the biggest rally for Palestinians ever to have taken place in Washington, D.C. The war is coming at a cost for Israel. Diplomatically, Bolivia cut off relations with Israel, with Turkey, Colombia, Chad, and Honduras recalling their ambassadors. Persian Gulf Arab leaders meeting with the U.S. Secretary of State. They all called for a ceasefire, but Blinken did not blink. No to a ceasefire, and on a humanitarian pause, a big maybe.
It's our view that a ceasefire now would simply leave Hamas in place.
Yet Blinken had only echoed Netanyahu's statements on a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas.
David Petraeus, the retired general of the U.S. Army, responsible in part for his failure in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, in a leaked audio file, encouraged and approved Israel's carnage in Gaza.
I see no alternative to the destruction of Hamas, and I use that term specifically because, as Aviv knows, there's a military doctrinal term. It's a gradation. You know, you can disrupt, you can deny, you can defeat, you can destroy.
But he must not have been prepared for what an Israeli minister said when asked whether an atomic bomb should be dropped on the Gaza Strip. Amihai Eliyahu said this is one of the possibilities. Let's not forget, the Gaza Strip has already been hit by an atomic bomb. But not at once. Slowly, 25,000 tons dropped on the Strip so far. The resistance fighters slammed these comments as reflective of the evil and terrorist nature of the regime, while they fought street battles against the Israeli regime forces. Israel has suffered casualties as a result. The tide may be turning, with costs mounting for the U.S. and Israel. For Israel, the worldwide anti-Israel protests have shattered its image. These protests have also worked against the U.S.
It's definitely ceasefire. People are getting killed every minute.
In the U.S., there are worries about the aftermath of the war. It's time for Israel's friends to recognize that the current operational approach is causing an unacceptable level of civilian harm and does not appear likely to achieve the goal of permanently ending the threat from Hamas, is what this high-ranking senator said. In other words, the U.S. is at the phase of the war where people are starting to worry about how they will look when this is over. And they are worried about votes also, as cynical as that sounds. Muslim and Arab American groups have threatened to not vote for Biden in 2024. This includes Democratic Party leaders from contested states that can decide elections, such as Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. That, combined with the sanctioning of Israeli products, which has also gained traction, especially amongst the Generation Zs in the U.S., and not just in the U.S., but around the world. Figures reported by the charity organization Save the Children shows the number of children killed in the Gaza Strip as a result of Israel's ongoing aggression has exceeded annual figures related to global conflicts over the past 4 years. The international NGO says that Israel's brutal military attack against Gaza, which began on October 7 in response to an operation by the Palestinian resistance group Hamas, has so far killed more than the annual number of children killed in armed conflicts globally in each of the past 4 years. According to multiple reports, including the Palestinian Health Ministry and the Defense for Children International, DCI, one child is being killed in Gaza every 10 minutes. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said in a press release on October 18 that since the launch of the indiscriminate bombing crusade against Gaza, an average of 100 children have been killed daily. Hundreds of children are still trapped under the rubble of residential buildings targeted during Israel's strikes on Gaza, and they have not been rescued yet, which implies the actual death toll could be higher. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said in a statement that at least 1,000 children are missing under the rubble in Gaza. The ongoing siege and the relentless bombardment are impeding search and rescue operations.
Gaza has become a graveyard for children. It's a living hell for everyone else. And yet the threats to children go beyond bombs and mortars. And I want to speak briefly now on two of those, water and trauma. The more than 1 million children of Gaza have a critical water crisis. Gaza's water production now, its capacity is at 5% of its daily output. So child deaths to dehydration, particularly infant deaths to dehydration, are a growing threat.
The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child has also issued a statement saying grave human rights violations against children are mounting by the minutes in the Gaza Strip. The statement says armed conflict harms children first and foremost and has lifelong effects on their physical and mental health, their development, and ultimately the enjoyment of all their rights. Children are also harmed when they survive, but lose parents and other family members and friends, and also witness catastrophic events. The committee has also called for an end to the devastating harm that's being leveled on children's lives in the occupied Palestinian territory. It has also called on all parties to protect all children and to provide all the necessary medical and protective support, including psychological support, to begin the long process of overcoming the consequences of these grave violations.
Then, of course, we have the trauma. When finally the fighting stops, the cost to children and their communities is going to be borne out for generations to come. Before this latest escalation, before it, more than 800,000 children in Gaza, that's three quarters of the entire child population of Gaza, were identified as needing mental health and psychological support. Again, that's before this latest nightmare.
In a desperate move, Palestinian children and their parents have started writing their names on their bodies in black ink so that they can be identified in hospitals if they are killed or injured in Israeli strikes. Children pulled from the wreckage of buildings are sometimes unrecognizable due to grave injuries. Heartbreaking photos of children lying on steel trays inside Gaza hospital morgues with their sleeves or legs of trousers pushed up to reveal their names have been going viral on social media. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said in a report last Tuesday that almost every child in Gaza has been exposed to deeply distressing events and trauma.
We're talking about children witnessing their parents, their families, their sisters and brothers being killed in front of them, their houses, their communities disappearing in a split second. This has a big toll on their emotional, psychological, and mental health.
The report highlighted that children are experiencing widespread destruction, relentless attacks, displacements, and severe shortages of essential necessities like food, water, and medicine. The report added that without stable electricity and fuel supplies, essential facilities like hospitals, desalination plants, and water pumping stations cannot work properly.
It's interesting, Amy, we have a formula at the United Nations that is applied to virtually every other conflict situation. But when it comes to the situation in Israel and Palestine, there's a different set of rules, apparently. And that's, I think, a big source of my frustration. Where is the transitional justice process? Where is the UN protection force to protect all civilians? Where is the tribunal for accountability? Where is the action on the part of the Security Council, the only mechanism in the United Nations that has enforcement to ensure protection in the occupied territories?
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Children caught up in war are always seen as innocent, helpless victims. That's why the Zionist regime and its Western backers are simply ignoring the plight of Palestinian children in order to justify this genocide. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, over 2,000 academics and students who specialize in the study of children and childhood have come together to call for an immediate ceasefire to halt the unfolding Western-backed Israeli regime genocide in Gaza and demand an immediate end to the egregious violation of Palestinian children's rights. Signed by students and academics from around the world, this statement draws on decades of research to highlight the immediate and long-term impact of settler colonialism, occupation and violence on the children's lives and the importance of speaking out. The statement proclaims, for many of us, entering this field of study was motivated by a desire to improve the material, social, and political conditions of life for children globally. We cannot, therefore, sit by as the situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate. The research focuses on how the adults around these children, parents, grandparents, carers, teachers, politicians, fearful for what the future holds for this next generation, protect and control this space of perceived innocence. The unprecedented scale and violence of these attacks compounds the long-standing suffering of Palestinians since the 1948 Nakba. Yet, there is a lack of will, even a refusal on the part of many powerful Western regimes to call for a ceasefire. Now is not the time for the silence. The first intifada, which broke out in December 1987, generated a mass of interest and research on the Palestinian children, both from international academics and international non-governmental organizations. No one is born a victim. People are made vulnerable and victimized by acts of violence and repression, just like those Palestinian children and adults forced into life imprisonment in Gaza, the Zionist regime's open-air prison. At the same time, children and young people have been the driving force of the two intifadas. Palestinian children make complex decisions about how to survive, act, and resist, while enduring unimaginable violence and subjugation by the Zionist regime forces and have inspired supporters of liberation, justice, and freedom around the world. In the current war on Gaza, one Palestinian child is killed every 10 minutes. Despite the high stakes, no one with the power to avert this genocide is looking out for Gaza's children. It is as if these young people are not seen as children or are excluded from the category of childhood altogether. This can be understood as an effort of the Zionist regime and its Western backers to sidestep humanitarian law and public sympathies for innocent children. Given the scale of the suffering of children in Gaza, the refusal of the UK government and the supposedly left-leaning leader of the opposition to support calls for a ceasefire has been horrifying but not surprising. It was, after all, the British government's Balfour Declaration, a cold and reckless calculation of British imperial interest, that laid the foundation of the Israeli regime by proclaiming support for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people with little consideration of its indigenous Palestinian population. Using the October 7 date as a reference point for the start of escalation amidst the history of 75 years of Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine and the 17-year blockade that has suffocated the Gaza Strip, this decontextualization stops the world from viewing the Palestinian cause as a just one, therefore stripping it of the right to receive international support, such as the demand for a ceasefire. The hypocrisy over free speech and academic freedom has hit a new low, as student groups in the UK are banned for their pro-Palestinian stance, and US universities lose funding for not condemning the Hamas fast enough. Unsurprisingly, it is Palestinian academics facing the brunt of this repression. As a result of signing the statement calling for a ceasefire, distinguished Palestinian colleagues, Professor Nadira Shalhoub-Kovarakian, was asked to step down from her position at the Hebrew University of Al-Quds. The news was circulated in the Israeli regime mainstream media, leading to further threats against Shalhoub Kevorkian and her family. Such intimidation tactics are also being used against academics of color. In the UK, two scholars of South Asian descent were singled out for their lawful expressions of solidarity with Palestinians on social media and harassed by the Daily Mail, the UK's largest tabloid. Retaliations against non-Zionist Jews who speak out are also on the rise. They are denounced as traitors in Israel and face real threats to their livelihoods and security from the Zionist regime, and its right-wing backers. The threat to academics' job security, however, pales in comparison to the recent horrors unleashed on the besieged Gaza Strip. Researchers, therefore, affirm the calls of the Statement of International Childhood Scholars and Students. Palestinians urgently need a ceasefire and an end to the Zionist regime's bombing campaign. Palestinian children's lives are precious. All Palestinian lives are precious. According to the website of Defense for Children International, the Zionist regime forces have killed twice as many Palestinian children in Gaza over the past month than the total number of Palestinian children killed in the West Bank and Gaza combined since 1967. Israeli regime forces have killed at least 4,237 Palestinian children in Gaza in 1 month since the Zionist regime military unleashed a massive military offensive on the Gaza Strip on October 7th, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza. There are an additional 1,350 children missing under the rubble of destroyed buildings, most of whom are presumed dead, meaning that over 5,500 Palestinian children have been killed in Gaza over the past 30 days at a rate of over 180 children per day. Between September 2000 and October 6, 2023, DCIP independently verified that Israeli regime forces and settlers killed 2,187 Palestinian children throughout the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime's forces killed at least 281 Palestinian children between December 9, 1987 and September 28, 2000, according to B'Tselem. Palestinian estimates suggest Israeli regime forces killed no more than 100 Palestinian children between June 1967, when Israeli regime forces occupied the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, and December 1987.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the organizers of the National Congress of the Martyrs of Lorestan Province on October 25, 2023. I would like to say a few words about the situation in Gaza. Because today, the issue of Palestine and the events that are taking place in Gaza are the Islamic world's most important issues. All of these events will shape the future. On the one hand, the matter of Gaza is about oppression, and on the other hand, it is a matter of power. Yes, the people of Gaza are truly oppressed, and this brutal, bloodthirsty enemy, the usurping terrorist regime, knows no limits when it comes to committing crimes. It martyrs 1,000 people in a single bombardment. That's how it is. It knows no limits. This is how the oppression of people becomes evident. But there are two important points alongside this oppression. One is the patience of these people and the people's trust in God. These people have truly been patient.
دنیا
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some of the scenes of what's happening in Palestine have been shown in the world's mass media and also in our country. Hizz, a Palestinian child, is martyred. He praises God. His child is martyred. He says it's for Palestine. A wounded teenager praises God and recites verses from the Quran. These people's patience is very important. The enemy wanted to push these people to raise their arms and surrender, but they didn't raise their arms. They didn't surrender. This is a very important point. This patience and their trust in God are the things that will come to their aid. This is what will make them victorious, and ultimately, they will be the victors. In addition to this, another important point is that the blow that has been inflicted in this event, in the attack by the Palestinian fighters on the usurping regime, was a decisive blow. Never before had such a blow been inflicted on the regime. And as I mentioned from the start, it is irreparable. As time passes, it becomes even more apparent that it is irreparable. Why do you think the president of the US and the heads of oppressive evil countries, the UK, France, and Germany, are continuously making their way there? It is because they see that the Zionist regime, is falling apart. They see that it is being destroyed. They realize this, so they keep going there to prevent its destruction.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
The Supreme Follow-up Committee of the Palestinian Revolutionary Factions organized a major protest in Yarmouk camp on Friday to support the resistance and condemn the massacre committed by the Israeli regime against defenseless civilians in Gaza.
We assure our people in Gaza that we stand with them resiliently, sharing their wounds and pain. We tell the occupying entity that we will liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque and meet our people in Palestine. We pledge to the resistance front to pray in Al-Quds.
The defeated Israeli occupation is taking revenge by killing children and women and historically destroying humanity.
We, the Islamic Jihad Al-Quds Brigades abroad, vote to enter Palestine and liberate it, as we promise to eliminate Israel.
With unbridled fury, demonstrators burned the Israeli flag, confirming that the Resilient Resistance Front has proven that American threats no longer intimidate anyone, and vowed to defend Palestine with their lives until liberation.
As the Palestinian Resistance and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah have stated, let America come. So we will fight our main and fundamental enemy. We are not afraid of America's intimidations, as it is more cowardly than waging a war.
We call on everyone and every country capable of doing anything to imagine their children thirsty, dismembered, lying in a hospital or buried under rubble.
Protesters called on international community to assume its human responsibility.